Kathy, can we, do a roll call?
Yes. Dr. Davidson?
Here.
Dr. Davy?
Present.
Dr. Davis Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Rakes? Dr. Stenhoff? You have three members, you have a quorum, Dr. Davidson.
Okay, thank you. Agenda item number three, call to the public. Do we have anybody in person or on the line that wishes to address the committee at this point?
We do not.
Okay. Then item number four, approval of minutes from September 9th, 2019. May I have a motion to approve?
I so move.
And a second?
I'll second.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? I have one minor item, and at the risk of offending my esteemed colleague and acting chair, Dr. Davis Wilson is listed on there as acting chair for the minutes of the 9th. And I don't know if that's typical, since I was present to chair, or if that is just a carryover. But I don't want to do anything to minimize the chances that you will serve as acting chair again in the future. Nor do I want to establish a revolt and have a vote of no confidence on my ability to chair.
Mr. Chair, I am glad you got that because I think it was a carryover.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. This is Kathy. That is an error on my part. I forgot to change it. It is a carryover. I'll make sure that gets changed before we post the minutes.
I did not see anything else. And hearing nothing from anyone else, then the motion carries.
To clarify, did somebody just join the call?
Yeah, it's Jeannie.
Oh, okay. Good morning. We will be getting to that agenda item in a couple minutes. If you could just hang on, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, no problem.
Okay, item number five, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendations to the board pertaining to approval of behavior analyst applicants. We have two applicants today. The first is Amanda Segarian. Ms. Segarian attended the Florida Institute of Technology between 2015 and 2016. She got a certificate in applied behavior analysis. She also attended Nova University and earned a master's in counseling from 2016 to 2018. She had her supervised experience at one site, the Behavior Analyst Support Services in Florida, under two supervisors, Jessica Andrews and Kate Nafidi, for over 1,500 hours. I did not see any major concerns, but I did notice a discrepancy in the application. So on page 15, page 13, and these relate to two different supervision forms submitted by Ms. Andrews. On page 13 of the application, there's the Arizona State Board of the College Examiners fieldwork verification form. It states the start date of August 1, 2015 to the end date of January 15, 2017 for a total of 1,826 hours, which is more than enough. But on page 15, using the BACB verification form, we list 1,1600 hours from the dates of August 1, 15 to 4:30 or April 30th, 2016. And again, with those 1,016 hours combined with the 648 hours that she received under her other supervisors, she still has more than enough hours. But I just wondered, in terms of this application, because we have a discrepancy there, do we need to request a change in the application or deletion of one of those forms or anything like that?
Mr. Chair, this is Diana. I would say that because she meets the minimum, I think we probably should be fine without, like, with the discrepancy, because the other form does show that she's at least met the minimum requirement.
Yeah. I mean, in both forms actually show that she meets the minimum. It's just that there's a discrepancy. And then there's one other thing on page 14 of the application. And this is, again, our verification form for Supervisor Ms. Andrews. Number 11, was the supervisor conducting the supervised work experience a relative, subordinate, or employee of the applicant? And the question was answered yes. So, if that's correct, we may not be able to accept those hours. If that's not correct, then that form itself probably needs to be resubmitted. Does that make sense?
Mr. Chair, in the past, we have on those ones required a request for additional information. So I do think that we should stay uniform with our process related to that.
Sure. Okay. So would this be a simple phone call, or is it a fair is it a letter?
I believe we've required a fair letter in the past.
Okay. Okay. I have no other concerns with that application, though. But we need to we would need to get that corrected, if it is corrected, before it goes to the full board. I would recommend that it just be approved by the board.
Mr. Chair, could we ask that that board staff verify, because we don't have Jean here and we don't have Jenna here, so I'm going off of pure memory and I may be wrong, but I think that if we do, I think that in the past we've done it in the form of a fair letter, and if we have, then I think that we wouldn't have the option of moving it to full board until the response to that letter has occurred. But so what I would propose is that maybe board staff could look at, I can give you the name of one applicant that comes to mind that we just recently had this with, and see how we handled it, and then could we just move to handle it the same way? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then that way, because I hear what Dr. Davidson's saying, is that we need to be able to, we want to be able to move these people through, especially if it's just a mistake. I just want to make sure that we do it consistent with how we've done it, and we've had a couple over the last few months that have come in like this.
Do you want to Mr. Chairman, Dr. Davis Wilson, in general, if the committee believes that this is an unintentional mistake or a typo, we've treated it as an informal request and move it to the board. for approval if I get the document corrected and get confirmation that it was just like a typo. But if you believe it is a correct answer, then you've done it as a fair letter and requested a formal letter with additional information. And when you do a formal one, it has to come back to the committee at the next available meeting once the documentation has been received.
Thanks for that clarification. I don't really know what I believe. I just know that checking yes would be would cause me to flag this application.
Ms. Barsavy, can I just make a suggestion that, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Perhaps we just we ask board staff to ask if it was simply a typo. If it is simply a typo, they can submit that page and get it back to us ASAP. If it's not a typo, then we can instruct board staff to move forward with a formal request for additional information.
That makes sense to me. Dr. Davis Wilson, what are your thoughts?
I'm fine with that. I just want to make sure that, because this isn't the first time we've seen this in the last 6 months or so, I just want to make sure that we're consistent with what we've done in the past. And we may have done that in the past, where we just reached out and asked if it was a typo. What would concern me is that if we just reach out to that for this particular applicant, but for the other two, we did require a letter, then we've got some inconsistency in our administration of how we handle that. And so I would second what Dr. Davies suggesting. I would just ask still that we double check on the last two that we've seen that way and just make sure that we're uniform in how we're addressing it.
Ms. Hooks, can you do that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I will take care of that. I will check for the last two we've seen, see how it was handled previously, and follow protocols.
That's great. Thank you. Any further discussion about this application? Okay, our next applicant is Yuko Johnson, Dr. Davey.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yuko Johnson has applied for licensure as a behavior analyst with the state of Arizona. She has completed her application indicating that her graduate education was done at the University of North Texas, where she worked through the Department of Behavior Analysis and focused on ABA in terms of gaining her appropriate coursework. Prior to that, she has a master's degree in special education. In reviewing the application, I found, again, no critical areas to address. However, I would just point out a few things to the committee. Question number 16 of the application, official graduate degree program title, graduate academic certificate. I don't know that would be correct. I need to go back and pull through the actual transcripts, but I'm not sure that's an accurate statement for number 16. I also noted just that the supervisor that signed off on her supervision period, the applicant filled out for a period of 1/6 to 2009. This is page 16 of the PDF document. 1/6/2009 through 7/31/2010, that the applicant submitted that to the supervisor to sign off. When the supervisor attested, the supervisor actually provided a period of 2008 to 2010 and then signed off on that. In reviewing the applicant's thorough responses to her experience in behavior analysis, it appears that she worked for that organization and for that particular supervisor for an extended period of time, but she is appropriately checked supervisor experience towards certification 2009 through 2010, number 23. And so that is my review of it. I see nothing stopping us from moving this forward to the full board. Perhaps just some clerical cleanup since it is a public document with regard to the title of that certificate. Which, as I'm looking at it now from the University of Texas, page 13, graduate academic certificates, if you look at the top left corner underneath degrees awarded, it would appear that the graduate academic certificate it would be in applied behavior analysis, not the graduate academic certificate. But again, just to clean up the documents, if it is public, those would be my only recommendations that board staff reach out about. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. So, page 16, the supervision form, we need to clean up those discrepancies from 1-6-2009, 5-19-2008, those two different start dates. Do I understand that correctly?
I don't know that that needs to be cleaned up based on the rest of the application. I think the supervisor just provided the entire period that the individual was at the place of employment. I think that the part that the applicant has filled out is correct and coincides with the applicant information. The only piece I think that I would ask the board staff just reach out to get clarification on is the name of the certificate that she received, which is question number 16.
Okay. And that seems like it could be done with a phone call, correct?
I would think so, that could be clarified.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Davey, this is Kathy. Just for information only, what I would have to do with that, because she has to change it, I would actually send her the application page by email and ask her to correct it and send it back so that we have a corrected application page.
That sounds great.
Oh, okay. But that would not be the same as a fair, and that would, and she could do that quickly hopefully get it moved forward to the board.
Yes.
All right, thank you. Any other concerns or questions about Ms. Johnson's application? Hearing none, can I have a motion regarding these two application?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I will make a motion to direct board staff to speak with both Ms. Sergerian and Ms. Johnson to determine whether or not we can get the clerical errors corrected before the full board. If they are able to do so, then we would move those to the full board.
All right, and a second?
I will second that.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. We have 5B is regarding the next item. 5B is behavior analyst application for licensure by universal recognition. This is for applicant Lanny Geisinger. Dr. Davis Wilson, will you summarize for us?
Yes, Mr. Chair, because we do have some students in the room, I am going to do just a brief overview of why this applicant is reviewed in a separate section from the other applications. Essentially, what has happened in the last year is that the governor has passed a bill that would allow for individuals who are licensed in other states in good standing to relocate to Arizona and be eligible for licensure in Arizona. It's not technically a reciprocity bill, but it is
the easiest way to think about it is kind of a reciprocity. It only is applicable to states that have licensure for behavior analysts. So if a behavior and psychologist, but if a behavior analyst if a state does not, like California, then that individual would have to go through the full application process if they relocated to Arizona. So this went into effect August 27th of this past year. So this is our second application review of what's known as universal recognition. And so I will go ahead and move forward with my review of this applicant. So Ms. Geisener, pardon the inability to pronounce her name, is currently active in Virginia. She has had a license in Virginia since 2016. Oh, I will add to that that you have to be licensed for a year in good standing in the other state when you relocate. So she's been licensed since 2016. She is relocating to Flagstaff, which is great because that is an area in great need of additional providers. And to prove residency, she has provided us two utility bills as well as the proof of a home purchase in the area. I have reviewed the application, and at this time I have no concerns, and I would open it up for discussion with my fellow committee members.
Thank you. Any questions or concerns from Dr. Davey?
No, I would just say moving forward, and, you know, having been privy to some of the discussions we're having at the full board level, you know, the question that's really going to start to come across in terms of the equivalently is whether or not Virginia's license requirements meet or exceed that of Arizona's. And so I think, you know, one of the things I went through was I went back and looked at, and I'm sure Dr. Davis Wolfman did the same, looked at kind of the Virginia requirements. And I'm just wondering, you know, in the future, and this is more directed to our wonderful board staff, if the location from which the applicant is coming from, if we could maybe get the information related to requirements for said state's entry into licensure as a behavior analyst. Is that something we think we could do in the future?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Davey, unfortunately, we cannot. The way that the bill was written, this is Diana. The way that the bill was written is that the only equivalency that is in question is the degree, the level of degree, which for behavior analysts is not really a huge issue unless we have a circumstance where we have a BCABA that's licensed in a state that is looking to come here and become licensed. But with psychologists, there are some states that license master level psychologists, and some of them are school psychologists or what have you. Here in Arizona, there has to be a doctorate level. And so the only thing that we have the authority to take action on or to define as a board is the education level. Not even the education requirements can be questioned, only the education level. So for behavior analysts, we should only see this in the committee if there were a BCABA that's licensed that's looking to move, because we don't license BCABAs because they wouldn't have the equivalency in degree level. That would be where that would come up. But to your point, Dr. Davey, we will see this often, and we have seen it, where more recently, you know, there's been cases that individuals are master level counselors, but under kind of an experience are able to practice as doctorate level psychologists in other states. Those individuals are not eligible for licensure here in Arizona.
So thank you for that. So I'll bring up two points. One, Virginia actually does license that assistant behavior analyst. Which I think it's interesting to note that is you know, something that this individual could have been coming through. She's obviously coming through as a behavior analyst, but in the state of Virginia, that is a very real possibility. I think my question really pertains to some of the rules we've had previously with regard to supervised experience
you know, whether or not the 750, the 1,000, the 1,500, the state of Arizona is very clear in the 1,500. And so that would be the piece I would be interested in, is whether or not an individual who may or may not be licensed in a particular state was licensed under an expedited or an expedited graduate level supervision path. So that is really where my question is coming from.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Davey, I do understand that question. This is one of the reasons why there was some kind of concerns about this bill. This bill trumps the statutory requirement of the 1,500 hours. So this bill basically establishes that if they have 1 year of good standing licensure in another state, regardless of the qualifications of that other state, notwithstanding the education piece, then they would be eligible. So someone who, you know, maybe in Virginia was eligible under 750 hours, or I know like in Kentucky, there's some other states that don't restrict to just the 1,500 hours, that if they were eligible under the 750, they practiced in that state for a year in good standing, relocated to Arizona, they would be eligible for licensure despite the fact they don't have 1,500 hours of experience.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Davey, this is Kathy. My understanding is that we are not, as staff, even allowed to get that information. We can't even get it verified. We cannot do supervised experience verifications for universal recognition applications. It's a completely different pathway to licensure.
Kathy, I'm wondering, since the one area that we do have the responsibility is the degree, the equivalency in the degree. If someone is certified as a BCBA as opposed to a BCABA, then we would know that they had a master's degree. Would you be able to look them up on the BCBA registry and provide that for us, so that question is answered? Or do we just simply look at their graduate education?
I think that's a question that we will need to ask Jean about, and unfortunately she's not with us today, because that is, I would need direction to know from the Attorney General's office that I can even get the registry information for these applicants. At this time, my understanding is I cannot, but there may be grounds for it. We need to ask Jean.
Okay, and we do ask for their degree information, so they put that on there. We just can't look up, we can't ask for the transcript.
Correct, and even under the standard application process, they aren't required to be BCBA certified at the time of application. They're only required to have passed the exam.
And Mr. Chair, we see that as a potential, and it's been a conversation in some of the rule writing work that we've done over the years, is that theoretically someone could let their national certification go and still remain licensed. And so so if another state has similar language as ours does, where the certification isn't required, just the passing of the exam, then that state would technically be able to license somebody who is not board certified, and that individual would be eligible under the universal recognition, provided they meet the degree requirements.
Yeah. But if we could just simply look them up and they were board certified, we would know that they did in fact have the degree, because the BACB requires that they submit their transcript. So I just was wondering if that was an avenue we could take.
Mr. Chairman?
With the one area that we have some authority to investigate, which is the degree.
Mr. Chairman, this is Kathy. In the law, ARS 3243.02, the Universal Recognition in Law, A3 says, when the person was licensed or certified by another state, there were minimum education requirements and, if applicable, work experience and clinical supervision requirements in effect, and the other state verifies that the person met those requirements in order to be licensed or certified in that state. My understanding is that a verification of licensure is proof that they met the minimum requirements for licensure, because they licensed.
In that state.
Mr. Chair, board staff, I do think to their point is we may want to present to the full board consideration and possible regulatory guidance on this issue, though, because one of the concerns that is a little bit different for us than psychology is that we do have essentially two different titles. But if someone is able to, as a BCABA, still get licensed in the state as a behavior analyst for some reason, and they lump it into one type of licensure, us not knowing whether they have a master's or a bachelor's degree could prove to be extremely problematic. I do wonder, too, if that, as far as, and it's not an agenda item, so you guys don't have to answer this per se, but, you know, from the psychology, you know, the psychology perspective, what in the universal recognition gave you guys kind of the red flag of the one applicant that we just reviewed, or was it that individual was inquiring? Okay, so that individual, for those of you on the phone, that individual was inquiring about the fact that he didn't have a doctorate degree and wanted guidance from the full board. So I think that goes back to the concern of, and while I understand the intent of the rule and stuff, I would hate for a state to say, oh, you can be licensed as a behavior analyst one and a behavior analyst two, because behavior, you know, the associate level or assistant level doesn't fit on their line. And next thing you know, we've got an applicant coming in that may really have a bachelor's degree. And how would we be able to recognize that? And likewise, how would this, using the universal recognition, if someone didn't inquire, how would they even recognize that? So now that we've taken some sort of stance on the fact that they need to have a doctorate degree for the psychology piece, how are they even going to be aware of that if we can't ask about education requirements? So Mr. Chair, Dr. Davey, I think from there, it seems like the board staff has a clear understanding of where the concerns are regarding the education level. So I do think that it would be beneficial for us to move that to a new agenda item and get guidance from Ms. Galvin on how we move forward with verifying education experience as far as equivalency in degree level.
You can put that on it.
This is Brian. I have one further comment around this. The other one circles around this particular applicant's information, I guess. Kathy, you would maybe be able to respond to this. When we pull the Virginia license, correct, or any other state license, the information that's provided essentially, particularly in this case, provide the start date of the license, the end date of the license, the occupation, name, blah, blah, blah. License status, current, active, right? So in Arizona, let's just say that there was an active complaint against the behavior analyst, against the psychologist. If someone was to just pull this particular, pull a screenshot from our registry, well, it wouldn't really show any of that, correct? It would just say currently active, correct?
That is correct. One of the other issues about open complaints is that the majority of boards, I don't even know of any board that actually will tell us if there's an open complaint. In Arizona, we're not allowed to for some of the boards. And so it's, even though it's in the law, it's very, very difficult to get that information.
And so, so if there's students listening, I'm not concerned about Lanny in this particular case. I'm talking more on the theoretical issue of the things we're going to deal with in the future. This application, this applicant's license in the state of Virginia expires in a month. And so, again, you know, not thinking that, I'm not saying that people are, you know, inherently cruel or trying to be, you know, hiding things, but if you were, say, under investigation or under a board of complaint, hopping to Arizona to have a clean license essentially put forward during that time, to me, would just be another area we'd want to be cognizant of. The only reason I flagged that is just recognizing, and it's natural. It happened on, you know, 3 years ago, the license was issued. It's going to end 3 years later. But you just kind of, I just kind of scratched my head in thinking about this as we're just now beginning to see these applications come through for universal recognition. So I thank you for listening to me with my conspiracy theory.
It's not easy to hop to Flagstaff and buy a house.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, yeah. This is actually a discussion we've been having a little bit as staff. Does the behavior analyst community report to the National Practitioner Data Bank?
Mr. Chair, my answer to that was no. I have been very closely reviewing some of the reporting requirements that the BACB has set forth. And, you know, one of the unique things about even reporting to our nationally certifying board is that we have to attest that we've obtained permission from all clients involved. Which is interesting because we have mandatory reporting requirements that then require us to attest. So for example, if I have a concern about a behavior analyst and either a client right's been violated or confidentiality has been breached or what have you, those are the two conditions under which I can bypass approaching the behavior analyst myself. If the client confidentiality or their rights are at stake, let's say I take over a new client. And I have concerns about the assessments that were ran. I can't go to the other BCBA and say, hey, I have concerns about the assessments ran because now I've got a confidentiality issue. So that's the one time that I can bypass approaching the BCBA directly and go straight into a board and a state board and a national board complaint process. Interestingly enough, I could under that circumstance, so I, you know, they maybe didn't conduct an FBA and should have, maybe they conducted an FA that the data was not aligned with the treatment plan recommendations, and as such the child's now sitting at the emergency room with no place to go. That would be a time where if the family says, oh no, but I really, really like Johnny Smith, he's the best BCBA we've ever had, I wouldn't even be able to report to my national certifying board because I don't have consent from the parent. What I would have to rely on is reporting to the state regulatory board and it, waiting for the regulatory board. And this is specific to each state as well, as the regulatory board at that point could say like, okay, well, we've taken action or not taken action and leave it there. We have a full board that's pretty adamant about please notify all other affected parties. So that would be how it would get to then the BACB. And I'll be reaching out to the BACB because they have concerns around the 30-day reporting requirement, where if I can't report because the family thinks that, you know, Jimmy Smith is the best BCBA ever, but I am obligated to report, then I'm in this really funky position with the BACB that I would have to rely heavily on our state board taking action and notifying the BACB. Which I think here in Arizona is a pretty consistent stance that we take. Not all states are gonna be that way. And so I second my colleagues' concerns about, you know, if someone were to just jump the state and that other board is not cooperative, which we do have some cases currently where the other boards are not responding to our requests for information, they're not responding to our requests for updates on cases. That is extremely problematic for both psychologists and behavior analysts. But we don't report then to any data bank beyond that. Food for thought, you guys.
Okay. So we have a new agenda item.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think that's what I was going to request, is that we formally put the discussion around the universal recognition as an agenda item so the committee can have open discussion about it at future meetings. As I think, you know, it maybe just needs to be a standing statement for a while as we work through this so that we're in compliance with the open meeting rules.
Excellent idea.
Mr. Chair, if I may, on that note, I'm going to go ahead and I am going to motion to move this applicant to full board.
We have a motion, a second?
For approval. For approval. Yes, sorry.
For approval. Right.
Second.
Okay. The motion, a second. Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you. Item number six, discussion, consideration, and possible action pertaining to draft of rule changes for behavior animals. Ms. Nicholson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and committee members. At the committee's last meeting on September 9th, the members had discussed the language of several sections in the behavior analyst rules to include the ethical standard and verification of supervised experience, among other things. At that time, the committee voted to make changes to several sections, and we subsequently contacted the rules writer, Ms. Hahn, to make those changes, which she kindly drafted the changes fairly quickly, and Kathy, I believe, uploaded the proposed rulemaking the other day along with a memo. We do also have Ms. Hahn, the rules writer, on the phone if there's any questions that the committee might have in regards to the proposed language. And if the committee approves these proposed rules, and I will take it to the full board for their review and approval so that we can submit a request to the governor's office for an exemption to the rulemaking moratorium, as they want to see the actual language of the rules.
Thank you. So just to be clear, we're looking at document number six, draft of proposed rule changes from Ms. Hahn. Is that correct?
Correct. And Kathy, I believe, had emailed a memo yesterday to all the committee members breaking down the different sections that were changed. But yes, number six is the actual drafted rules by Ms. Hahn.
Okay. Thank you. Committee members, any questions or concerns about what's in that memo from Kathy?
Mr. Chair, I do have one question for Ms. Hahn, and this is, I read it two ways, but under the ethical standard, so Rule 426406, it states, I like the language, you know, the concern that we had with that, and again, I'm just bringing some of the audience up to speed, was that we had the language that stated that we incorporate by reference a specific version of the ethics code from the Behavior Analyst Certification Board. The problem is that rule...
That is what's required by law. If you're going to incorporate by reference, you have to have a date-specific incorporation.
Correct.
Go ahead.
Correct. And so that was the issue that we ran into, is that if the BACB changes anything, then we've got two sets of standards. And so we wanted to change that language. So we had asked Ms. Hahn, who did a great job, and how we could redraft that whole section to take out incorporates by reference so that we don't have to have a date-specific version in there. So my question then for you, Ms. Hahn, is in the first statement of in fulfilling its responsibility under law, are you referring to the responsibilities under law as in our role in the protection of the public, or are you referring to statutory language? Because one of the things that behavior analysts don't have in our statutes is anything related to ethics. So I wanted to just bring that up and make sure.
This relates, the way I wrote it, puts the burden on the board.
Okay.
And the board's number one responsibility is to protect public health and safety. So,
Perfect.
Yes, and enforcing the licensure, disciplinary, all the things that the board enforces, it's going to follow this. The reason I focused on the board was because if you focus on the analysts, you're making a requirement for them, and then that needs to have something specific that they can follow, right? It has to be date specific. So I had to focus on the board.
Yeah, no, Ms. Ann, that makes perfect sense. I just wanted to make sure the specific law that it was referencing was specific to the intent of the board's role and not any potential statute. Because in the psychologist statute, there is a section that says that that psychologists are to abide by ethics adopted by in rule. We don't have anything in the behavior analyst statute that says that anything about ethics. So I just wanted to make sure that I understood that responsibilities under law is referring to the responsibilities of the board in general and not a specific statute.
That's right. And the way the statute you just quoted regarding the psychologist would require a date-specific incorporation.
Okay.
You don't have anything in your statute, so yeah, you can do it this way. It always makes me nervous to do it this way, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I can't promise you. You know, Girk may have other opinions, but I think it'll pay us.
You know, the full board may also have other opinions. so we got to get through them first, and then we'll...
That's the first hurdle to the board.
Right. We got to get through our colleagues on the full board first, and then let's hope we can get it through GERC. But thank you for your work on that. I think that language really did capture what it was that we presented as concerns related to specific dates.
Right.
I do.
Gotcha.
This is Dr. Davidson. I appreciate your language on this too. And I do think it will help us be more nimble and be able to stay up to date. And so far, each version of the ethical code has been a new and improved version. Hopefully, the BACB won't take steps backwards. As I read the language of this, the board shall rely on the most current version, blah, 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 unless the board determines public health is safety is not sufficiently protected by the current version. So in the past, the BACB has done this sort of thing in a couple of ways. They might say, effective on October 1st of next year, this will be the new ethical compliance code. In other situations, they have said, and I don't know if they've done this with the ethical code or not, but it's possible that they might in the future say, effective immediately, this is the new code. So just procedurally, If it were a date in the future, we as a committee could certainly prepare the full board that this is going to happen, this is a change coming up, and then the board can put it on their agenda and say, we have no objection. But if it goes into effect immediately, then would we simply adopt this, since the board must, in your language, the board has basically it's assumed it's adopted unless the board determines otherwise. How would that work?
Well, I'm not your assistant AG. You've got an excellent one, but that's never caused me not to express an opinion. So. As I see how this is written, you could do whatever the heck you want with regard to the professional and ethical standards of the BACB, whether they are going into effect in the future or in the past or immediately. You simply have to, if you don't follow what is their current standard, the one in effect today, when you're making a decision, you simply have to make a determination that the code that's going into effect 3 months from now protects public health and safety better than the one that's currently in effect, so you're going to rely on that one. Or you're not going to rely on the current one, you're going to do X and so because it protects public health and safety better. If the code goes, if amendment to the code goes into effect today and you're a little squishy about it, you have only to do a determination that says, nah, we think that the code that goes into effect today does not protect public health and safety sufficiently, and we're going to do X. And so as I read it, you got as much flexibility as you could possibly ever want.
Mr.
Which is always my...
Thank you.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, I do have just one statement to that, and this is, again, more of your historical resident bringing up just one point of conversation. You know, we have worked very hard to align with BACB standards. This does give authority to the full board to differ from the BACB standards. Now, I like the language of this. I like the flexibility. I like the intent. So far, the committee has been able to really substantiate our stance and present to the full board, and there haven't been any issues with that. But being that... we did come up with the specific by incorporating for the purpose of aligning with the BACB. I just want to fully disclose that in addition to all of the benefits that we see of the language, as well as, you know, the flexibility and what have you, that again, that also gives the full board the ability to disagree with a standard set forth by the BACB, which wouldn't just be at a committee level. That would be at a board level. So again, I'm still comfortable and confident with it. I just know historically in conversations that we've had, there's been some concern around that. I think that the concerns that we have not, have been more hypothetical and have not really been problematic for us. So again, I'm confident moving forward, but I just wanted to make sure that you guys understood the reality of in having that kind of flexible language, that it could be a circumstance where the committee says, well, the BACB interprets it like this and we find that to be fine. And then that goes to the full board and the full board says, uh-uh, we disagree with the BACB's interpretation. So, and then that would go under vote. So even though we do have representation on the full board, it would still go under vote. And so I just wanted to make sure you guys were aware that that would be an added, like I said, I still think it's a positive move, but that'd be an added consideration that I think you guys should just think about.
Okay, any further discussion about the ethical standard in the language that Ms. Hahn has recommended? How about the supervised experience language?
Mr. Chair, may I go back to the education requirement in Ms. Hahn?
Yes.
Ms. Hahn, you are... just providing us with some strong work here. I greatly appreciate it. In reviewing it, just one question. I think it might be just a typo. I'm not sure because I'm not going to pretend to have mastered the English language. But under B1, from an accredited...
Okay, I need you to give me a full cite. I can't find it with just B1. There are lots of B1s in the document.
Oh, sorry. This is under... I'm actually reading... the document that was provided to us by board staff by Kathy.
It's rule 404.1B2 education requirement.
Yeah, correct.
Mr.
Okay,
Chairman,
got
members,
it.
Ms. Hahn does not have the memo. She only has, it didn't even occur to me to send it to her. I apologize.
All right, well then, and maybe I'm wrong because I'm looking at the memo document right now, but just under one from an accredited institution of higher education. Should that be a semicolon versus a colon there?
Hang on, I'm still looking.
And, you know, I'm guessing if I'm wrong.
Can you help me? Can you help me know exactly where you're talking?
Yes, R4-26-404.1.
Yes.
B2. Education.
Okay. Got you.
Okay. B, your recommendation to us was to be a licensed behavior analyst in Arizona. Combined individuals shall have a master's degree or higher completed from an accredited institution or higher education. Should that be a semicolon and versus a colon?
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Davey, Ms. Hahn, I apologize. I'm looking at the actual rule, and that colon was stricken from it. And it, when I copied and pasted, I didn't catch it. It shouldn't be there in the memo. That's my typo, not Ms. Hahn's.
I'm sorry.
Oh, thank goodness. Okay.
Well, I'm not knowing the English language, so I'm glad we're all somewhat correct. So thank you very much. And Mr. Chairman, we can continue to supervise the experience. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So any questions or concerns with the recommended language under supervised experience? R4-26-403-C2. All right, how about verification of examination? R4-26-403-B3. Can we move on to repealing reciprocity? R4-26-407.
That's the one that concerns me. I need some guidance from you because I need to include in the preamble to the notice of proposed rulemaking an explanation for why you repealed it. So I just need you to tell me.
Mr. Chair.
We have a reciprocity statute, but it truly isn't reciprocity. It's you are eligible to apply for an application like anybody else would apply for an application. There's no difference in how that application is completed or reviewed. Therefore, it truly isn't reciprocity. Somebody without a license in another state or in our state would have to fill out and follow the same procedure as somebody with a license in another state. So the idea of calling it reciprocity was kind of misleading.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Hahn, I'm trying to wrap my brain around Ms. Galvin's guidance on it as well, and board staff, maybe you can help. So essentially, and to Dr. Davidson's point, the whole reciprocity thing, especially in the behavior analytic community, is confusing because when we see it, we automatically think, oh, okay, cool, I'm licensed here, I can come over and get licensed there. Now that was more of a concern, obviously, before universal licensing, but still could be a concern. What if someone, you know, is in Utah for a period of 3 months and then gets transferred to Arizona? They would have to go through the whole application process. They wouldn't be eligible for that. So the idea of having the reciprocity in there was just it felt funny to us because it wasn't really reciprocity. Now it looks like Ms. Galvin is suggesting that that the statute itself says may. So technically, mm-hmm. we don't have to have it. So we could delete the rule. And if that were to be the case, then the stance of deleting the rule would be really just to avoid the confusion, because in other states there is reciprocity in which if you are certified as a behavior analyst, then there's reciprocity to then licensure. And so I think as a field, it's a little confusing for us. But then the next question that we had was that, you know, that could be cleared up with the new universal recognition. But based on, and again, I am still trying to wrap my brain, the universal recognition is going to require statutory changes already. We already know that. Like, even though we're acting on these things, there's still statutory language that needs to be reviewed this upcoming session. So our options at this point would be to wait until that's done and then decide, you know, because once we make statutory changes, we've got to, you know, go back into the rule writing stuff as well to match the new statutory changes. So if I'm interpreting it right, our choices would be, do we come up with some substantial reason as to why this needs to go, or do we wait until the statutory changes happen? And then once that happens, then we may already have our substantiated rationale as to why this needs to change. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Yes.
Okay.
I think I can write an explanation. It doesn't have to be super detailed. I'm going to simply say that because the standards for licensure by what has been called reciprocity are the same as for a person who is not coming from another state, the rule was like accomplishing nothing, was simply adding confusion.
Yep.
So you're removing it, right?
That would be simple enough.
I'm sorry. Are you there?
Yes, can you
hear me? Yes, this is Dr. Davidson, and I said that is correct.
Okay. I can do that. Like I said, it doesn't have to be as stupendously detailed. I just need to address that I understand you're repealing something, and a little explanation is needed. That's it. Thank you.
Okay. Any further discussion on the reciprocity? Hearing none, then I think we have we addressed everything on this topic?
Mr. Chairman, this is Kathy. Have you addressed verification of examination, R4-26-403C1, moved to R4-26-403B3?
I'm looking. Was that in the memo?
Yeah, it's on page 2 of 4 in the memo at the bottom.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Any questions? Or concerns about the recommended language? I see no concerns with that. If the language is clear. Committee members, any concerns, or do you need another minute?
I'm good.
All right. Thank you, Kathy, for pointing that out. Is there anything else that we overlooked in this item?
I believe you covered all the sections that were going to be amended.
Okay. Ms. Hahn, thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm going to hang up.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, moving on to item number 7, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding unlicensed remote supervision in states that offer licensure and suggestions for related statute changes.
Mr. Chair.
Dr. Davis-Wilson.
Can we go back to 6? Because there were no substantial changes, I think the next step is to move this to full board, which would involve an action. Can I go ahead and make a motion to move the proposed rule changes to the full board for approval?
Yes, indeed. Do I have a second?
I will second that.
Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Okay, item number 7, unlicensed remote supervision in states that offer licensure. Dr. Davis-Wilson, can you summarize for us?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Dr. Davey, at our last meeting, we came up with several potential areas of statutory change that will need to occur either more immediately because of concerns that we continue to run into, or at a later date because of the upcoming, 2022 changes from the BACB. I was tasked with taking those items to the full board and reviewing them for the full board's discussion and review, and they have sent me back with two discussion items. The first one is probably of their highest concern, and so we're going to go, that's agenda item 7, and then I'll discuss the others in 8, but they're both under kind of the same introduction. So one of the issues that we presented to them was the continued kind of confusion around remote supervision, in that it's not clearly articulated whether it's in licensure or rule to the general public that the supervisor's location is not the location in which we're looking at supervision. So it's where the actual clients are being served that that we've defined, or that we as a committee have moved forward with in defining what state regulatory requirement it follows. So for example, if I'm a teacher in a school district here in Arizona, and my clients are here in Arizona, then regardless of where the supervisor is, the application of behavior analysis to those individuals would fall under Arizona state license, which would then require that an individual have a license in Arizona to serve the members in Arizona and be licensed to practice. And so what discussion that they've tasked us with to then bring back to them is what we as a committee could see from a statutory language perspective, or if we can't, it needs to be addressed in rule, ways that we can provide clarification to that issue so that people are not going through 1,500 hours of experience where both the supervisor is technically practicing without a license, but also the trainee is practicing without a license because they're serving the public of Arizona without proper supervision and without proper licensing. And so, so I think that the discussion at this point needs to be where we would recommend fitting in some sort of statutory language change that could capture the need of that clarification.
Thank you. Just for my own sake, let me put this in my words, and you can tell me if I'm correct or not. As an example, a supervisor from Michigan who is providing remote supervision to a supervisee in Arizona must be licensed in Arizona, and whether or not he's licensed in Michigan is irrelevant. Is that
correct?
Is that the issue?
Correct.
So where and how do we make changes to statute to convey that?
Correct. And I believe, let me find it in the statute. Hold on.
I'm looking at statutes 32.209.1.03 education and training standards for licensure. As we all know, this is fairly broad and it defers to the BACB or to a nationally recognized behavior analyst certification board. I'm wondering if we have one exception in that paragraph. About 1,500 hours. I wonder if it would be an opportunity for us to add another exception in the same paragraph relative to the need for licensed supervisors.
Mr. Chair, I would agree that that's probably the best location to do so. I would also add in there that while the changes are 2022 to remove the independent fieldwork university practicum and intensive university practicum, if that does end up being the statute that we revise, that we propose language to remove those three different titles because they're going to be irrelevant. I'm fine with keeping the 1,500 hours because the BACB is also moving towards 1,500 hours as a minimum. I do think that, you know, because it does state if the State Board of Psychologists and Examiners does not agree with the standards set, they may adopt another, like that captures kind of the rule writing process, but I agree that it doesn't really capture, I think the 1,500 hours, rather than it saying, I think of supervised work experience, and rather than it saying independent field work, university practicum, intensive practicum, we add, you propose adding something there by a licensed behavior analyst in the state in which the supervised experience occurred.
Licensed in the state, yeah.
Yeah, licensed in the state in which supervised experience occurred. Well, we got to be cautious, though, of making sure that if it's a non-licensing state,
the state offers licensure.
Oh.
Yeah, but if it doesn't, so like California, so if we were to be too prescriptive there, then someone who is in California and wants to relocate to Arizona would be ineligible because they, in the state in which they provided the services, there is no licensure. So we might want to be cognizant of that. But I agree with you that would be the location that I think it would need to fit in.
Because it might not fit nicely as a clause or as another single sentence, do we have the ability to recommend a 32-2091.03A? A subversion of that where we could explain this in a little more detail?
I don't see why we couldn't do an A and a B. If you look at 32-209107, there is an A, B, and C.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that is a good idea to break up that paragraph to make it more clear. Because it is a hefty paragraph, and I think people possibly look at it and think like, yeah, you know, and it says National Behavior Analyst Certifying Board 65 times and, you know, what have you, that it may be beneficial for us to break that into like an A, B, and C.
Okay. It's also interesting that the title of that is Education and Training Standards. We have no title for supervision standards. But it might be assumed under training.
Yeah, I think it is. And then in the rule, it's specified as supervised experience. I do agree that it's an interesting title, but.
So we, I'm just going to shoot from the hip here. The licensee's supervised experience must also meet the standards set by a nationally recognized behavior analyst certification board, except that the supervisor for if the experience was obtained in a state that licensed behavior analysts at the time, the supervisor must also have been licensed in that state at the time. So in that state where the experience occurred at that time. And that would, you could get more specific, but it would imply that if the supervision was remote, Michigan or not, that person would have to have been licensed in Arizona if supervising someone in Arizona.
Yes. So, Mr. Chair, I have, and I like that proposal, is that we could potentially propose, and this is like super early, like we don't have to craft the language perfect because as we're aware with the rule writing, the language crafting will happen along the way. So this is just to get something to the full board as like, here's what we would recommend. So I agree with that. And so where it says except that, then we probably could break that into one, the number of hours required for supervised experience must be at least 1,500 hours of supervised work experience. And again, get rid of the three different categories that are pointless. Two, if the experience was obtained in a state that the licensed behavior analyst at that licensed behavior analyst at the time of the supervised work experience, the supervisor must be licensed in the state in which the experience occurred. And then the standards adopted for the supervised experience must also be consistent with the standards set by the nationally recognized behavior analyst certification board. And number four would be if the state board of psychologist examiners does not agree with the standards set by the nationally recognized behavior analyst certification board, the state may adopt an alternative standard. So that would be except that and then those four exceptions. My only point of clarification would be in the one, I like your language, Dr. Davidson, of if the experience was obtained in a state that licensed behavior analysts at the time of the supervised work experience, the supervisor must be licensed in the state in which that experience occurred. My only concern is that in the cases that we've reviewed so far, we've got two types. We've got the ones that are getting supervisions in the school and the behavior analysts are under the impression that they're exempt from licensure, and so those individuals are not able to accrue hours to become licensed themselves. So that's one issue, which I'll talk about in agenda number eight. But then the other issue is that, you know, when we've talked to some of these applicants who are having to redo their hours, all of their hours, because, and speaking, you know, to the audience, if you live in Arizona and you do your supervision and the supervisor is not licensed, you can't be eligible for licensure yourself. And so these individuals who are using remote supervision are actually being required to go and obtain additional supervision above and beyond the 1500. So it's very important that we clear up this language so that there's not any of that confusion. Not all programs have awesome ethics teachers that talk about this. But to that point, the question that continues to come up, Dr. Davidson, is what is the location of experience? Is and what these applicants have come back and said is like, well, the supervisor's experience is occurring in Michigan. So they're not really, so I think we might need to define by experience something that includes the location in which the provision of services occurred. And by services, the services by the behavior analyst trainee.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think when we say experience or location of services, the argument that the applicants are coming back with is, but she's licensed in Alaska, she's licensed in Michigan, and that's where her services were provided. And so I think we need to maybe clear that up of wherever the behavior analyst, the behavior analysis trainee's experience was or their hours were. Like, I think that needs to be specific there.
Yeah, but whatever language we can come up with to clarify that, I would agree. The other thing I would say is, the supervisor must have been licensed at the time of supervision. So we've had some cases where a supervisor may have become licensed later on, but they're licensed now, but they weren't necessarily licensed at the time that supervision was happening, even though the state has adopted licensure.
I have that. So, Mr. Chair, I've got in here for just that exception. If the experience was obtained in a state that the licensed behavior analyst, again, I cannot read. If the experience was obtained in a state that licensed, that's why I can't read, because I had a type wrong. Behavior analyst at the time of the supervised work experience, the supervisor must be licensed in the state in which the behavior analysis trainee provision of services occurred. Maybe that's just our first round like draft, and then the mm-hmm. language can be crafted mm-hmm. from there. But I think that captures all of those points of that we've heard back from people related to, well, no, the supervisor never left Alaska, they're licensed in Alaska, or they never left Michigan, they're licensed in Michigan. I think the location of services is confusing people.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think this is a good start for statute that would add clarification to that. Any other considerations regarding that issue?
That's all I had. I think that's a really good start for us to bring to the board.
Excellent. Do we need a motion on that?
I don't believe so. No, because we were just, they requested us to propose something to them. So we're just meeting our administrative responsibilities to draft something to provide to them. And they did request that it go on the 10-4 meeting already. So they have already asked that of us. So I think we should be good.
Great. Dr. Davey, are you okay with this?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think, you know, this is just kind of putting some placeholders out there. The real crafting will come later on, so we've got some homework to do.
Okay. Then let's move on to item number 8, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding potential statute changes, including but not limited to ARS 32-2091.08, exemptions from licensure. Again, Dr.
Davidson. Mr. Chair, so one of the areas of statute that continues to be problematic, and again, just for educational purposes, for the audience, what, anytime that there is a statute that limits either our interpretation of application approval or complaint screening or what have you, and it becomes a consistent issue, changing it requires us to go back through the legislative process. And so what our committee has suggested is that since we're already going to have to go through legislative process for the universal recognition issues and some of the other bills, that we kind of piggyback on that, because every time you open legislation, it costs money. So it's one of those of like, let's get, you know, as much bang for our buck as possible, which is why we're reviewing these statutes today, is because we know we're going to have to move forward with statutes for other reasons. And so if we can tie these in there, then we don't have to worry about opening statutes at a later time, which does have a cost associated with that. Okay, so with that being said, the other areas that I brought to the full board's attention was the exemptions from licensure. And specifically, one that has been kind of a sore point for me for quite a while, and then I know that we've talked about it at length as well, both on the committee and prior to the committee's inception. And that's going to be the statement regarding licenses or licensing requirements. I'm trying to pull it up, sorry, of a behavior analyst who is employed in a common school. So a few thoughts that I have on this. So the actual article states that, or the actual license exempts individuals that are a behavior analyst who is employed in a common school, high school, or charter school setting, and who is certified to use that title by the Department of Education if the services or activities are part of the duties of that person's common school, high school, or charter school. Long story short, this is not applicable to behavior analysts. The Department of Education does not have any other certification for behavior analysts available to them. I think that this was a drop in kind of exemption from the psychologist statute. And the psychologist statute is specific to master level school psychologists who are certified by the Department of Education. And so the problem is that we have a lot of behavior analysts who work in the school setting who are not licensed. And in my personal opinion, they're in violation of this statute, because this statute clearly says, and who is certified by the Department of Education. And so to use the title behavior analyst, well, the Department of Education doesn't have that title. So, I mean, it's one thing if you're a certified teacher and you happen to also be a behavior analyst, but you're acting in the role of a teacher, that doesn't require licensure because you're not acting as a behavior analyst, you're acting as a teacher. But outside of that, if you're a behavior analyst employed by the schools, you still need to be licensed. And this is one of the issues that we're running into with the supervision, is that applicants, trainees are getting their supervision in the school setting, and then they're going to, you know, a private setting or a clinic setting or what have you, and they're wanting to obtain licensure, and we're having to say, sorry, your supervisor wasn't licensed. And to me, I am really struggling with how, as behavior analysts, we even apply this statute, because there's nothing equivalent to it. And my proposal would be that we remove it entirely.
Thank you. Can I ask you a couple questions?
Absolutely.
If that was deleted from the exemption, then that would that necessitate all behavior analysts who work in schools, private, public, charter, whatever, they would all need to become licensed?
Mr. Chair, I would argue that they all already are required to be licensed. That's my argument to that, is that there is no Department of Education certification. And so as it stands today, my interpretation of this statute would be that those that are in a school system practicing behavior analysis as a behavior analyst are practicing without a license.
Okay. The one of the issues
Dr.
you
Davis,
mentioned.
Dr. Davidson, could I just, you were, I mean, you have kind of the dean status of when that exemption was being carved out way back in the day, you know, the whole, you know, half decade ago. What was the purpose of that? Why do we have that exemption to say, hey, if you're in a school operating as a behavior analyst, we don't want to force you into licensure? Did it have something to do with PBIS programs? Did it have something with not necessarily the title, but the practice? Was there arguments to the effect that special education teachers use positive reinforcement, therefore someone could say that they're using the practice of applied behavior analysis without a license? Like, what was, do you remember kind of the tenor and the tone of what led us to that exemption?
I have a recollection. Let me preface that, whether it's true or not. but I do, and throughout that discussion, it was my recollection of those discussions was about, in part, schools were already doing SBAs. Schools and there were already school psychologists who were charged with that, those tasks. And it was, I believe, part of the concern was if you were going to be required to, that they could not, that school psychologists and school personnel could not be doing FBAs and developing behavior support plans that do in fact include behavior analytic principles and operations, that they could not do that without a license. And although many schools now do employ BCBAs, some licensed, some not, there is still a great deal of work that happens by teams, doing their best to assess the function of the behavior, using strategies like and tools like prevent, teach, reinforce, following certain protocols to come up with a functional hypothesis and behavior plans that that we follow. Some do it better than others. I think there was a fear that the school employees could not be doing that work, and therefore schools would have to stop and expend money hiring people, hiring licensed behavior analysts that they couldn't afford. And that's my recollection, but whether or not that is all of it, or whether that was even part of it, that was my recollection.
Mr. Chair, that's congruent with my recollection as well, having been someone who was, back in a previous life, a special educator, having worked inside of a private special education day school setting in Arizona. My concern would be in stripping out this exemption that you were going to have some significant problems in terms of, it's not a title issue, it's a practice issue. What if I have paraprofessionals running discrete trial training? What if I have a special education teacher who wants to write a behavior intervention plan? I don't know that we are in a place to really remove those much needed capabilities and projects and programs from those receiving special education services. Further, I don't know that we could do that, and then it may fly against federal law under IDEA, as well as state laws, to what individuals receive under FAPE. And so I understand Dr. Davis's Wilson's statement that they very well may be engaged in some form of practice of behavior analytic services, but I'm concerned at the possibility of just ripping that exemption out for all the comments that we've just made.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Davey, that is covered in the exemptions already. This article does not prevent a member of other recognized professions who is licensed, certified, or otherwise regulated under laws from rendering services within the person's scope of practice and code of ethics, so long as they do not claim to be a behavior analyst. And so I would argue that the issue still goes back to the school psychologists. And that the school psychologists do have a certification by the Department of Education. The Department of Education certifies two types of employees, teachers and school psychologists. And so by saying that these individuals have to be certified by the Department of Education to use the title behavior analyst, there is no certification, and therefore everybody in the schools right now that are practicing as behavior analysts without a license do not meet the statutory requirements for exemption. So I hear everything that you're saying, but it's addressed here. We've got the non-credentialed individual who delivers under supervision. We've got the members of other professions deliver. Those are all covered in here. The concern that I have is that the Department of Education does not have a certification. So the alternative would be to say that if you're employed by a common school and you're a behavior analyst, you don't need to be licensed. But I still don't think that that addresses your guys's comments, because this is clearly saying a behavior analyst. So we're not talking about the paras. We're not talking about all those people. They're actually covered in Section B. This is specific to a behavior analyst who is in the school setting. And I will add, because I was also a part of the original licensing conversation, one, there were two other pieces. One, we wanted parity with psychologists, and so I think that there was that piece, that if it was an exemption on the psychology side, then it needed to be an exemption on behavior analysis side. So that was the other part of that argument.
Yeah.
And the other part of the argument was specific to capacity, where at the time that licensure went into effect, there were less than 35 behavior analysts in the state. We now have over 500. So I think that for me, I still stand firm that line is extremely problematic, because, I mean, think, we've had two applicants come through who did their entire experience of having to redo it because the school behavior analyst was not licensed. And so I just think that it causes more confusion. I don't think it addresses the concerns that you guys are presenting. I think that those are addressed in other sections of this specific exemption. And if there's a Department of Education certification for behavior analysts, and that's around, please, I've looked high and low, and I'm only seeing teachers, and I'm only seeing school psychologists. So again, if you're a school psychologist and a behavior analyst, you don't have to be licensed. I get that. But if you're just a behavior analyst who's like, well, I'm going to work at the school to avoid licensure, that's a huge problem. And all of those individuals at the current statute today are already practicing without a license.
Dr. Davis Wilson, I agree with you that there is no state certification for behavior analysts, and that it's misleading, and we should change that. I do have a concern about eliminating the exemption for behavior analysts, even though it has been it's used as an exemption, it's been misinterpreted. But if it's eliminated altogether, I'm wondering what impact that might have on public protection. Would it in any way cause schools to employ fewer BCBAs that are currently doing the work of protecting the public and providing a good service? And I'm thinking about, are there BCBAs working in schools who, because of how they were certified, I know of one person who whose coursework, I think it was coursework, it was a BCABA many years ago, and then became a BCBA and a BHCB allowed either, you know, partial coursework for the BCABA or partial experience, but somehow, and this has been a long ago conversation, but somehow that person would not qualify for licensure, was not interested at the time, was working in a school, and I just wonder if there are people who are BCBAs but wouldn't qualify for licensure, who would now not be able to serve in those schools. Can you think of any situation when that might be the case?
Mr. Chair, I have a few thoughts to that. One would be that we're already proposing rule that would grandfather kind of sunset prior education requirements. And so we have other means of helping and assisting those people. Two, the individual, again, can be employed by the school and be called something else and not be, you know, misrepresenting themselves as a behavior analyst. That doesn't mean that they would lose their services. Three, I really do have concerns about the idea of public protection from the perspective of not having any type of regulatory authority. I have had people say, I am going to go work for the school district because then I don't have to be licensed. And so to me, that's a problem. I think that there's you can still work for a school district. You can still engage in activities under IDEA if you have the proper scope of practice. The concern is if you're advertising yourself as a behavior analyst, and again, I'm thinking of all the supervisees who are losing hours because of this. I'm thinking about what happens if the behavior analyst does do something harmful. What is the regulatory authority over that individual? Nobody. They were exempt from licensure, so sorry.
Ms. Wilson, can I just make a comment to that? I think that in many respects, they are not exempt from regulation. They're exempt from our board's governance. They would be subject to, if they are a BCBA, subject to that disciplinary review process outside of our purview, correct?
Potentially, the process together, so yes, the answer is yes, but I'll tell you in my review of the disciplinary stuff that the BACB will not review anything unless it comes through the psychology board first, and so that's where it's problematic.
And Dr. Wilson, as someone who sits on the BACB code compliance committees, this person would not be subject to Arizona licensure laws, and therefore the review board would take it up.
Correct.
Because there would not be jurisdiction by a state, so they would have oversight of that. So there is protection. I understand what you're saying.
So,
please take this as a spirited debate. We're all trying to do the same thing.
Right.
I understand what you're saying. I just get nervous about the schools. I look at that language and I think, you know, they do make the statement who is certified to use the title. They don't necessarily refer to a certification.
Yes,
it could
certified
be that,
use the title
that,
by.
That, yeah, by. So they're not providing a certificate or certification. They're essentially just saying the Department of Ed says this person can call them that. Maybe they do hold the BCBA. And so I just don't know. I can't recall, and I don't know that I have notes anywhere of why this was such a concern and why it's in there. So I just have a little bit of pause around the unintended consequences there.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Davey, I do have a question for you with regard to then if I were to file a complaint with the BACB and I have to have permission from the client involves parent, how do we protect the public if the client involves parents does not want to cooperate with the behavior analysts? Like I cannot file a complaint with the BACB unless I sign that I've obtained permission from the client. So how do we, how do, like, and this is more of just a general, because I just came across that, and I'm wondering, like, how do we then mitigate that? Because if it's a school district with a concern, or I'm hired at, you know, for an IEE, and I come in and I have a concern, but I don't have a relationship with the student to go to the student's parent and get permission, then how do I file that with the BACB?
I'm not sure that I'm legally qualified to answer that question or all the ins and outs that would be there.
But do you get, like, I still think that there's...
A bit hypothetical.
So, well...
But nevertheless, it is relevant to this discussion, right? I mean, if it's somebody operating in a school as a behavior analyst, and maybe not even calling themselves that, but they are a BCBA, if they are not licensed in Arizona, the court, and there is an ethical concern, then what can be done? That's what you're getting at, right?
Correct. Mr. Chair, Dr. Davey, the other thing too that I'm trying to wrap my brain around this. Most of the individuals that are in the school that I'm aware of that are employed by the school are licensed. Many of them are. And they're licensed because they either A, recognize that they're not certified to use that title by the Department of Education, because again, the Department of Education doesn't have a title for behavior analysts. So many, or they're not making enough money or ends meet, so they're also doing supervision on the side or taking on cases on the side outside of school hours. So most of the individuals that I know are indeed licensed and maintain their licensure. Also, many of the school districts are expecting them to provide supervision towards certification. And so those that are aware of the licensing statute have to have their license to provide that supervision. So again, for me, the statute is more muddy than it is anything else, because it's for people who don't understand that the other implications, that just read this statute and say, well, I'm exempt, and then they're going about doing things that don't really meet the intention of this statute. And that's where I'm concerned. Like, I can go work in the hospital system as, you know, under my doctorate of behavior health and still be a behavior analyst and just not call myself a behavior analyst. And I can still practice under the scope of my education and my training under the next section that talks about the other, under section B that says this article does not prevent a member of other recognized professions who are licensed, certified, or regulated under laws. And so, again, for me, I'm still struggling to understand why or how we're protecting the public in allowing for someone to work around licensure when there's other, shouldn't say there's other ways to work around, but I think the intent of it is far more confusing, or the interpretation of it is far more confusing than the intent. That's where I'm concerned, is that, again, the proposal, like we can all agree that who is certified to use that title by the Department of Education needs to come out, because that is not relevant to behavior analysts, and unless there's language that is out there that I'm missing, that's not relevant. So, but even if we kept a behavior analyst who's employed in a common school, high school, or charter school, and those services or activities are part of the duties of that person's role at that school. So in other words, they couldn't be employed there but then have a side gig on the weekends, right? Like we can agree with that. I'm still struggling to understand why we wouldn't want the licensure protection in place for those individuals.
I'm not sure that I have an answer other than my concern about would it cause schools to lose otherwise better qualified people than they've had in the past.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to assess that, but that is a concern that I have. And I would like to find a way to, I don't know, take a poll, but, you know, do something to try to better understand that. I was just going to say, the other thing that you've mentioned several times, Dr. Davis Wilson, and I agree completely, is the harm that's done for a trainee who can't count hours because their supervisor was unlicensed and they did all their hours in the school. I see that as a part of a bigger problem that we have, including reaching out to other states, supervisors in other states, et cetera. And I see the solution to that is perhaps a better job on our state association with some guidance from one or more of us as individuals to say, look, this is it. We need to get the word out frequently that anybody embarking on receiving supervision should ask these questions of their prospective supervisor, you know, and things like that. I don't know that, we could eliminate this, and we could require licensure of all behavior analysts in schools, and that would help that other issue. When people are being supervised in schools, but it still won't help the issue of remote supervision from people in other states. So I think we need to do a better job of reaching out to prospective licensees in Arizona. But I still would like to find out if there's a way that whether or not students would be disadvantaged because in any way, and I honestly don't know right now.
Mr. Chair, I have just a couple of things. One, I wonder if we could maybe reach out to now with. That being said, we have tried this in the past and have not had much success, unfortunately. But if we could have board staff reach out to the professional association and see if they have information pertaining to what you're asking, as far as how many behavior analysts, how many board certified behavior analysts are here in the state that are not licensed because they're employed by the school, and possibly what is the reasoning behind that. So maybe two-parted question of, are they not licensed because they knew they were exempt from licensure? Are they not licensed because they're school teachers and acting in a school teacher role? Which I know a couple of behavior analysts that are actual classroom teachers. And so again, they are certified under the Department of Education. They are teachers and they would be covered under Section B of other profession. So I hear what you're saying, and I think we could look into that. Again, for me, being a part of the original language, there were the three parts of A, how do we make sure paras, behavior specialists, school psychologists, those people aren't restricted from doing FBAs, but again, I think that's covered under number B. The second argument was, well, if the psychologists have this in their statute, the behavior analysts want it in theirs. So that was one of the, and it was a legit argument at the time. And then the third one was the number of behavior analysts available to serve the public. And so, and again, that argument is, we've grown by thousands of percent, right? Like we've grown drastically. So all three of the arguments there, I still don't see how they fit this statute. Now, to your point, who's going to be affected? I do know of two districts that hire behavior analysts, and they do expect the behavior analysts to pay privately for the licensure. But those behavior analysts have chosen to do so because, one, they feel it's required because some of them are former supervisees of mine, and so they know my qualm with the language and then others of them are doing side projects anyway. And so I don't know, there are companies that don't pay for licensure. I know of ABA providers that don't pay for licensure. And so I'm just struggling to see why the schools then would say, well, if you have to be licensed, then we wouldn't want you here. I don't know that that would make any other difference unless there was a differential pay between the two, which wouldn't be the case. I think the argument would be whether or not the employer should pay for the license or not. And if that's the case, then I know 20 plus agencies that do not pay for licensure for their employees. And so and it's fine. We don't, please know, like, I'm not trying to sell you guys on a stance. I stand firm on my stance. I'll be clear on that. But I'm just trying to wrap my brain around, and I agree we could probably, you know, reach out to the association and see. I'm trying to wrap my brain around how this would affect any of that.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, I think my biggest concern, and we can have, I mean, I've got a hard stop in 5 minutes. I apologize. And I know that'll quash the quorum, but my biggest concern is I agree that there is some language in here that appears to protect the certified special education teacher, but I do not see language that for B, where it talks about licensed, certified, or regulated under some laws of the state. I would want our AG to weigh in that a special education teacher falls underneath that, or someone who's teaching under emergency certification, because we do have a huge shortage of special educators across the state. I would also want to know that under their extended authority, so if you look at A6, you know, BCBA, or a licensed behavior analyst, essentially can extend authority to a non-credentialed individual. Does the special education teacher have that same ability to extend it to their paraprofessionals that may be running the screen trial methodology or reinforcing appropriate behavior or doing whatever? If we can clean up some of that language and maybe get the AG to help us understand how we could protect those involved in the special education side of the house, I have no qualms. I agree that if you are a ECBA, you've taken the coursework, you're in our state, you should be licensed. I have no issue with that. My issue is protecting those in both our public and private schools that are served under special education practice and the authority that is extended from special education teachers to their classroom staff. That is where I stand on it. So if we could get some help with that, then I'm all about licensing those that should be licensed.
So, Mr. Chair, Dr. Davey, so if Section B said does not prevent a member of other recognized professions who is licensed, certified, or regulated, if we were able to also tie in there or operating under the extension of somebody who is licensed, certified, or regulated, because I hear what you're saying there, like a parapro, for example, they would not otherwise be certified, but they may be acting in under the extension of a speech therapist or a teacher of some sort. So I think that is a good point of clarification that we could have in there. I also think under the laws of this state, I think maybe clarification or federal of some sort. If it's not, we can talk with Ms. Galvin, but I do know IDEA is not state specific, and unless we have a state law to already reference it, I would have concerns that mirror some of what Dr. Davey is saying. And then from there, I think that would resolve some of the concerns, if I'm hearing you right, Dr. Davey, that if we could clean up B. Okay. Yeah, so if we could clean up B, kind of
from Dr. Jameson's standpoint of protecting the public, and your standpoint, I'm also trying to protect the public that may be receiving services currently, just not through licensed behavior analysts, but through our educational system, and under probably less than what we would like kind of training or aspects, but the reality is that is the education system that we have across the country, and we need to make sure that those students are getting that service, whether it's A services or B services or C services. We do not want to step into the place of where we're shutting that down.
Yeah, no, I can definitely live with that. Now, I do have to get this over to the full board for next Friday. And so we can do it multiple ways. One, we could say that I'm hesitant to say that we don't have a consensus on number one, because again, that opens it up then. Dr. Davey, you'll be at that meeting, right?
I will be there live and in person.
Sweet, me too. So we would have to articulate why there is not a consensus, which then could potentially leave it up to the full board to make that consensus. Or we could, I know for the sake of time, we could draft the language, but if we were to say we need to remove number one and beef up number B or B in the proposal, would that be something you're comfortable with, Dr. Davey, or would you prefer, or sorry, Dr. Davidson, or would you prefer that Dr. Davey and I take the stance at the 10-4 meeting that we don't have consensus on what the appropriate action of this language is, but we know that something in the statute needs to change because the "and" in that number one is irrelevant to the practice of behavior analysis?
I think we have consensus that the "and" part can be stricken from number one. And I think that it would be fair to represent to the full board that part of our discussion was implications of our actions on public protection and wanting to find out more. And, you know, so I, for one, since this has been a concern of mine throughout this discussion, I would be happy to reach out to our professional association and inquire about what kind of what kind of help they could provide in terms of reaching out to help answer that question.
Mr. Chair, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but I don't believe that you can reach out. I believe the board staff has to. But what I would propose, and this happened on another issue, is that maybe Dr. Davidson be CC'd, and then if you guys continue to not get a response from them, then maybe you guys can mitigate that with him as the chair being included in the email, because that is what has happened before on some other public policy things, is that we have reached out to the board staff has reached out to the professional association has not responded. It, as board members, we can't then go to the board, to professional association and say, hey guys, you guys need to respond. We have to stay completely out of the role with the professional association. So if the professional association chooses to not respond to the board staff as they have done on three or four different matters over the last 6 months, there's nothing we can do. Like, I can't, you can't, we can't call up a board staff and say, here's information, because that would violate public meeting rules.
When we reach out, when staff has reached out to for the professional association in the past, whatever happened in the past, would it be possible for staff to address and reach out not only to the president but to the chair of the public policy committee and any other committee that might be relevant to this issue, in hopes of getting a better response?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would be happy to work with the board staff. I know we've got some time to get them the information of who to reach out to. But again, I will tell you that this has not been, we've got four things that we've done that with, where we've reached out to the president as well as committee chairs, and Jenna's attempt to coordinate with them went unresponded to. So we can try, and that's frustrating, because obviously I just wish that we could just pick up the phone and call them and say, hey, call them back or respond to this. But unfortunately, we're really at the mercy of them being able to respond. And again, we run into issues. The moment that we have a conversation with them, it could put us in a recusal position or some sort of other issue. So that's, I think it's worth a try, but that is definitely
so
a challenge.
If I am copied on an email, and then somebody from the policy committee or the president himself contacts me, what can I do or say?
Mr. Chair, what I've done in the past, because like I said, this has been over the last 6 months something that Ms. Jones had to deal with, is they would CC me, and then of course, to your point, then the committee of course forwards to me and says, hey, what is this about? And my response has been a general, you know, the board or the committee has directed staff to reach out to you. Please contact them. And so, again,
yeah.
We can't talk about it. I can't give details, but I can tell them, yes, this is something coming from the committee. Please reach out and speak to them in hopes. But it's got to be very, very neutral in how we address it. So, unfortunately.
No, that makes sense, and I can do that. Thank you.
That's why I do like the CC part, though, like including including Dr. Davidson, because then they may try to reach out to him, and then he can just say, like, please reach out to them. You know, they are asking, and even though he can't provide details, it at least is not, like, an erroneous attempt to reach out to the board. Mm-hmm. However, we've done that, and the committee still no-showed the meetings anyway. And never responded to Ms. Jones about why they did not attend. So again, there's only so much that we can do to try to promote and encourage participation. I'm grateful to have students in here who understand or who are learning how important it is to be a part of these processes. So hopefully we can continue to educate how important it is to take that role in the professional association as well. Alrighty.
Okay.
I was going to say, Mr. Chair, I know Dr. Davies got to go. I'm comfortable representing this matter at the 10-4 meeting. Dr. Davies will be there as well. So with your guys' approval, I will go ahead and address that number one has some potential access to care concerns, and that number B probably needs to include some level of extension as well as some consideration to federal mandates.
Thank you. And I'm comfortable with your representation.
Fantastic.
Okay.
And this is Jennifer speaking. The next agenda item, number 9, there is something that we might actually need a motion on in regards to someone's noncompliance with the CE audit. So if we could just do that briefly before Dr. Davidson.
Okay. Are we ready for that one? All right. With the CE audit update, Dr. Bolera has been notified of his deficiency. He has till December 20th to complete his CE and send it in, or send in additional. Mr. Craigshead has not responded to any of our attempts to contact him. Certified mail was sent following the September 9th meeting. His response due date is today. No response, if we get no response from him by 5 p.m., the next step would be to open a complaint for non-compliance.
And this is Jennifer, and just to add on to what Kathy's saying in regards to Mr. Craigshead, I did speak with Ms. Galvin with respect to his non-compliance. We have tried multiple avenues to get a hold of him. I know we've also emailed him, and the email is bouncing back, and it appears that he's out of state. So at this point, she indicated that if we don't receive any response by the 5 p.m. due date today, that the committee can make a motion to open a complaint for investigation. We will send him notification, and then I'll do an investigation and bring it back to the committee for their review. And then at that point, whatever the committee's recommendation is, it'll then go to the board for ultimate review and decision.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I do have a question for board staff. Are you guys able to, and this obviously we've got a 5 p.m. deadline, so that won't be the case today, but are you guys able to go through the BACB portal to reach out to?
I don't
We could try.
Because I do wonder if some behavior analysts update that, but don't necessarily update the licensure board of changes. And I'm wondering if perhaps you had like a work email that he no longer uses, and maybe his personal email is through that way. If you guys are able to do that, and you may, before you do it, want to check with Ms. Galvin. I mean, it's like one last effort. But for me personally, and I don't know how you guys feel on the committee, I still think that then warrants additional concerns, because we are required to report changes of address and contact information. And so if it is that you can reach him, I think that's a different issue.
Right, and we can check the portal to see if we can access that, but as you mentioned, it is his professional responsibility to update his contact information to the board within 30 days. And we have exhausted all information, I believe all avenues of trying to get a hold of him at this point. Go ahead, Kathy.
Yeah, this is Dr. Davey. I think I'm comfortable making the motion that if we have not heard from this individual by 5 p.m. today, that the complaint be opened. I agree that board staff has done their due diligence and provided even regular mail and certified mail. And so, you know, whether or not the email address is working or not working, definitely our U.S. Postal Service does. And so my motion is that as of 5 o'clock today, if the information has not been returned to the board staff, that the complaint be opened.
All right, do we have a second?
I'll second that.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to say, Kathy, you were going to add something. Did you want to add something else to that? Are you good with?
No.
Okay, perfect. All right, none here.
Okay, all in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you. Then next item, number 10, new agenda items for future meetings. First of all, our next meeting is October 28th, which is a Monday. Secondly, we have one item which came up earlier today, how to verify the education for universal recognition. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, and then also just a general discussion around universal recognition as a standing agenda item.
Okay. Anything else?
I have one more, probably more so for board staff. Would it be possible for us to have a section, you know, in the full board we have like board updates, would it be possible for us to have a section or talk about having a section? I guess we'd have to talk about having a section that would include board updates. We've had, this isn't the first time, but there's been a substantial change on the current board, and I feel like there's a disconnect between what we hear at the board versus what the committee gets to hear. And so I think when there's any substantial changes, or there's a need for, there's open seats, or there's some sort of announcement that would be made to the full board, I would like to discuss how we could incorporate that to the committee so that Dr. Davidson, Dr. Senhoff, and Dr. Rates are able to be kept in the loop. I know Dr. Davy and I are kept in the loop, but if it's not on the agenda, we can't share it with them.
Absolutely.
So. That's all I had.
And that is a very good point, so that we can keep the committee in the loop with some of the changes that are going on, so we can definitely add that to an agenda item going forward or in the future when things come up.
And I think that we had it, you know, when Ms. Jones retired, and now we've got an appointed interim director,
right.
We've got, you know,
a lot of changes.
A lot of changes going on that I just feel like the committee should be kept in the loop with, and that would be a really good way to do it.
Absolutely.
I like that idea. Thank you. All right. Anything else? Then can I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
So moved. I'll second.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. All in favor, say aye.
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 Oh, I wanted to say one thing. I wanted to thank board staff for one thing. Board staff, I so appreciated the graphic about the licensure.
that you included in the packet with the states and the dates that like which you went into effect. But thank you so very much.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good. I thought I might keep that in there going forward for all. Anytime we have a verification from someone who's not in a state that does not offer licensure, I thought I'd add that just to make it easier and nobody has to go look it up.
I love it.
Thank you so much.
Good. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for the feedback.
All right, we are adjourned.